Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of the podcast Axios Today. I'm in for Jen White. This is the news roundup.
Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation. And I ask every American to join me in this cause.
Vice President Biden became President Biden this week in a stripped-down inauguration that still made room for lots of fireworks. He's already hit the ground running, signing more than two dozen executive orders, memorandums, and proclamations after taking the oath of office. He's expected to roll out even more today, including some aimed at sending stimulus checks and food aid to struggling families. We have a lot to talk about, so let's jump right in. Shane Harris covers national security and intelligence at The Washington Post. He's also host of the Rational Security podcast. Shane, welcome.
Hi, Nyla. It's good to be here.
And Leanne Caldwell is a congressional correspondent with NBC News. Hi, Leanne. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nyla. Great to be here.
We'll get to the inauguration itself in a moment, but I wanted to start off with this flurry of executive orders and presidential directives. Shane, what type of things are these orders covering?
Well, it's covering a lot of stuff, actually. Most directly, I think, and immediately of interest to Americans is the pandemic response. So there were a number that were directed at things like a federal mask mandate on federal property and efforts to try and speed up vaccinations as well as testing across the country and trying to bring a much more coordinated response to the government's management of the coronavirus pandemic, which, of course, is in its most lethal point now. And the president actually said publicly will probably kill half a million Americans. We'll probably reach that number soon. But there were also other important reversals of Trump-era policies, notably rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, which is something that the president, Trump, had pulled us out of, revoking his ban on travel from predominantly Muslim countries, the so-called Muslim ban, which will allow people to see family members potentially soon that they haven't in a long time, and halting construction of the border wall along the border with Mexico. So really kind of trying to turn back some key signature policy efforts and initiatives by the Trump administration and making it clear that this was sort of these were day one priorities for President Biden, making good on some of his campaign pledges as well.
When we're thinking about those day one priorities, Leanne, if there's this theme of dismantling President Trump's agendas, I wonder what orders didn't have anything to do with the former president, but instead did involve Biden introducing some of his own priorities.
That's right. The theme, of course, is trying to undo what Donald Trump did, which many Democrats think were just atrocious for the country. And so these were priorities. But there's other things, too, that Biden did that Congress couldn't get done, including extending the eviction moratorium, extending the student loan moratorium. These were things that were discussed in part of the last COVID relief bill, but on a very limited basis. For example, the eviction moratorium is supposed to end on the very last day of January. And the reason Democrats in their negotiations with Republicans in this last $900 billion bill weren't pushing for a longer eviction moratorium, for example, is because they expected Biden to come in and extend it on his own as one of the first things he did. And so he did do that. There's another thing as well as far as the minimum wage is concerned, and that's one of his newest executive orders that he just signed last night or early this morning. And that's a $15 minimum wage for federal employees. Well, there's lots of contractors, people who work for contractors who are hired by the federal government. $15 minimum wage has been a big priority for Democrats for many, many years. And so this is one way he can get at least touch that policy, that priority around the edges.
And of course, all of this is being overshadowed by the pandemic, to your point, Leanne. And I wonder, later in the hour, we are going to be going deeper into pandemic news. But Shane, to go back to your point, more than half of President Biden's orders had something to do with COVID-19.
Hospitals are out of beds. Businesses are closed for good. Schools are caught in between.
And while the vaccines provide so much hope, the rollout has been a dismal failure thus far.
Shane, what do we need to know about some of these coronavirus-targeted orders? What are they, and what, to your mind, is the most significant of them?
Well, they're really largely aimed at both spurring the development of testing, which is something that actually we have done a very poor job of in the country. We don't have kind of rapid same-day tests that people could use to know if they were safe to go to work or send people to school. Those things could actually be transformative to the economy, helping it get back on track. But, you know, testing and the failure of testing was kind of the original sin, I think, in the federal response. It was always botched from the beginning. So he wants to try and spur that with some new federal initiatives. And then there's going to be efforts to try and get money more efficiently to the states and to local governments to help them distribute the vaccine. I mean, at the end of the day, the military is not going to like come in and distribute vaccine to everyone. This is a very state and local driven effort. And there's good reason, good policy reason for that as well. But we've been seeing a very uneven distribution as this thing kind of gets off the ground. And I think Biden wants to try and direct money that was in the most recent stimulus package, but also kind of bring some coordination to that. They're finding, I think, officials when they come in that there really was no plan per se for how to do this. Now, we've been tracking dosages of the vaccine at the Post, and what we're finding is that we are actually now on track of this 1 million vaccines a day the Biden administration will need to hit if it's going to actually, as he says, he wants to vaccinate 100 million people in his first 100 days in office. So that's a kind of a big ticket initiative for him. And then some of these other, you know, pieces of the, around executive orders of involving enforcing federal safety workplace codes so that people don't get sick when they go to work, mask mandate on federal property, which will help and is also kind of a symbolic effort too, I think. So I think it was, you know, this raft of orders is all trying to basically communicate to the public, you know, this administration is going to take a much more kind of centralized and leading role in the national response to the pandemic than the Trump administration did.
Leanne, what has been the Republican response to these coronavirus orders so far?
Well, it's really interesting because I remember during the Obama years, Republicans would shout at the top of their lungs about their opposition to the President Obama's use of executive orders to go around Congress. And then when Donald Trump came into office, he did the exact same thing, but on steroids as well. And then so there's the issue of the actual use of the presidency and the executive branch to do these executive orders. And then there's the content of them as well. So Republicans right now actually are a lot more silent on the use of executive orders than I expected. I thought that there would be more outrage by Republicans about them. There hasn't been some widespread opposition on their use and necessarily of the contents as well. You have some who are complaining about some of the immigration executive orders, the halting of the border wall construction, and the reversal of the Muslim ban. But as far as the COVID response, I cover Congress and it's been pretty silent. There hasn't been a lot of outrage about what Biden is doing regarding COVID.
And of course, we heard such a theme of unity from the president during the inauguration. His inaugural address sounded very different than President Trump's did back in 2017. Shane, I wonder what your sense is of the overall message of that address when it comes to, does that give us clues as to what he's planning to do in these next first 100 days?
I think so. I mean, it was, by, you could almost read it in some ways, I don't know if I go so far as to say a conciliatory speech, but he's trying to give people by example, you know, a reason to communicate with one another, to listen to one another. He talked a lot about healing and trying to bridge divides. And, you know, that has been a consistent message throughout his campaign. Biden really positioned himself as somebody who was able to speak not just to his Democratic constituents, but to appeal to Republicans as well. And people, you know, who traditionally voted Democrat, who found themselves voting for President Trump 4 years ago, that, you know, kind of traditional base of predominantly white working class people. So he was trying to, I think, to hit that message as well. At the same time, the political reality is stark, right? The Democrats control the Senate, yes, by the slimmest possible majority. Their majority in the House has narrowed. We are at a time of enormous, you know, rare polarization, perhaps not seen since the 1860s. And I think his speech also was directed at acknowledging that, too. I thought it was also notable that he did talk about the attack on the Capitol on January 6th and specifically called out white supremacists and political violence and political extremists as saying that this was something that was just unacceptable in American politics and was threatening to our democracy. That gave a whole, the attacks on January 6th obviously gave a different kind of a tone and cast a shadow somewhat over the inauguration. But so he clearly addressed that, but is, I think, trying to commit to the idea that if we listen to one another, we can get things done. We will see. Washington may not really be in the mood for that, but he's hopeful that that kind of sense will maybe sweep over the country.
Leanne, what are we hearing from Republican lawmakers now in terms of this, as to Shane's point, a conciliatory tone?
I don't think anyone should believe that everyone is going to agree on policy moving forward. There are going to be deep, deep divisions and debate regarding policy. You're already starting to see that with Republicans starting to make some waves about their opposition to the president's COVID plan, and some of them don't want another $1,400 in direct stimulus payments, hundreds of billions of dollars going to the states. So unity is one thing as far as personnel is concerned and personality, but unity on policy is a whole other subject and going to be very difficult.
It's the News Roundup. We'll be back with more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
President Biden campaigned on uniting the country. He now takes office just weeks after a pro-Trump insurrection. The NPR Politics podcast is there every day to break down the transition of power as Biden takes the reins in Washington.
Before we move on, we had to make room for one of the most talked about moments of the inauguration.
We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the windswept Northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Amanda Gorman, who was the sensation of the inauguration. Shane, how did she rise to such a high level at such a young age? And I wonder, I see you shaking your head there in amazement. How, it's such an interesting thing how she became the breakout star.
It really is. And I confess that I did not know her work and was not aware that she was the National Poet Youth Poet Laureate, if I have that correct.
Yes.
Until the inauguration. She's 23 years old, I believe, has obviously been writing poetry and reading it for a long time. I did not know what to expect when she stepped up to the podium to deliver this this poem, but obviously it was just incredibly on of the moment and spoke to just so many anxieties and fears, but also hopeful feelings that people have right now, and was just delivered so beautifully. And if you know, you couldn't see it as we were playing it, but she was moving her hands like she was conducting the rhythm of her own words. It was just really striking. And in some ways, with no disrespect to the president, might have actually overshadowed the inaugural address. It was quite eloquent.
Well, President Biden did get to work almost immediately. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki did hold a briefing for reporters on Inauguration Day.
If the president were standing here with me today, he would say he works for the American people. I work for him, so I also work for the American people. But his objective and his commitment is to bring transparency and truth back to government, to share the truth even when it's hard to hear. And that's something that I hope to deliver on in this role as well.
Psaki says Biden is committed to bringing, quote, truth and transparency back to government. Leanne, has the administration made concrete steps in this direction already?
Well, they've started holding briefings again, the daily press briefing, which is a step in the right direction. But now that the White House is acting in a more normal fashion, and I use the term normal just to compare to how the Trump White House worked, which was in a very abnormal way, they are holding background calls with reporters, sending out information about policies, and there's planned rollouts, and everything's coordinated. They're talking to Congress on how, on timing. It's just a much more smoothly running operation, running as an operation, not just as a man, as a person. But I think that the challenge also for the press is the press who is appreciating a return to normalcy and being able to cover policy and being able to access the White House in a way that many White Houses before the Trump administration did. There's a challenge for us as reporters not to to let things slide, to let this air of transparency, because there are press briefings, get in the way of our reporting. They say that they're trying to do that, but also it's the very beginning of the administration, and there's going to be challenges and there's going to be problems, and it's going to be upon the press in this new world, of which is similar to an old world, to be on top of it.
Leanne, would you say that Psaki answered reporters' questions, especially as we see now two briefings? Is that happening?
It's a mixed bag. There was a couple times where she said that she danced around specific questions and didn't directly answer. And there was a couple times where she, as Dr. Fauci said at the podium as well, one of the nice things about this is if we don't know the answer, then we just have to say that we don't know. There's always going to be growing pains in a new administration. The transition was very, very rocky between the Trump administration and the Biden administration. So there's a lot of things that the Biden administration is having to catch up on. And so it could be a rough few weeks for Psaki, who is the face of the administration, as things get up and going. But there's a really high bar, especially coming back from the Trump administration, which was, this word is way overused, but unprecedented in how it dealt with the public and the press. It was mostly Twitter.
Speaking of getting things back up and running, Shane, I wonder if you can give us an update on Biden's cabinet picks. Who's been confirmed, who hasn't?
So one person has been confirmed. That's Avril Haines, who is the director of national intelligence. This is the official that oversees all of the 17 or so intelligence agencies and is kind of the central manager. Notably, will be the first woman to lead the U.S. intelligence community. And then General Lloyd Austin has actually now received a waiver from Congress, which is required for him to go through the process of becoming confirmed as the next Secretary of Defense. He is not 7 years out of uniform, and the law says that you need a special dispensation from Congress if you're going to serve in an appointed role. So those are the two that are kind of here now. But it's notable that he didn't have any confirmed secretaries on day one. I mean, usually you like to see this process getting a little more quickly up to speed. He has all of his nominees in place. I think now they will move to try and get the Attorney General confirmed. Already we've seen a nominee for CIA. That will be a couple of weeks away, I would think. Notably, he has said that he's going to keep Christopher Wray as the FBI director. There was some question about whether he would keep him in that position, which is a 10-year tenured position. So the cabinet is kind of getting up, but it's also important to note that we're going to have an impeachment trial coming up pretty soon, too. I think the Biden administration would very much like to get these confirmations out of the way before we move on to that trial, which it sounds like from the minority leader in the Senate, McConnell, is probably not going to be happening until next month. So that may give some breathing room to get these nominees confirmed.
I wanted to ask you about, to that point of Donald Trump officially leaving the White House on Wednesday, flying to Florida, did not participate in President Joe Biden's inauguration. He did hint before he left that this may not be his last time in Washington.
So just a goodbye. We love you. We will be back in some form.
When we think about the fact, Shane, that Trump was impeached twice during his presidency, we know, by the way, to your point, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has now announced the House is going to be delivering articles of impeachment to the Senate on Monday. If the Senate impeachment, if that trial happens, you know, depending on that outcome, that could prevent him from running for president again. Shane, what's the likelihood he will be back in some form, even if it's not elected office?
Yeah, I think that the likelihood that Donald Trump will simply, you know, go quietly into the night is practically zero. So the form that it takes is going to be, that's the big question. Will it be another run for office? And I think that, you know, it's not implausible to me to think that that you could find 17 Republicans to vote to convict him at the impeachment trial and then take a separate vote to block him from running again. Now, he could try to contest that. But I think that more likely what we're going to see is Donald Trump continuing to try and have influence on the national stage. I think that the part that he liked best about being president was it made him the most famous person in the world, in addition to being very powerful. And Donald Trump, before he entered elected office, was a television personality, basically. He's a celebrity, someone who's kind of famous for being famous. Now, whether he wants to become a kind of Republican kingmaker and have influence over races, I think that honestly remains to be seen. And I think you clearly are seeing these schisms develop now in the Republican Party, where there is a wing that includes people like Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and I would even say Mitch McConnell, that don't want the Republican Party's future to be tethered to Donald Trump, who is a, you know, disgraced, defeated president, who arguably lost them the Senate and the House in 2018 and certainly lost the White House. So future in politics, I think it's a question mark. Future on the national stage being Donald Trump, I think, is a near certainty.
Shane, to your point, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell did call Trump out on the Senate floor Tuesday for helping to incite the insurrection on the Capitol 2 weeks ago.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people.
Leanne, McConnell could vote to convict Trump in the Senate, but at the same time, we also know that he's already pushing to delay the impeachment trial until February, despite that news that the articles will be delivered to the Senate on Monday. What's McConnell's strategy here?
So McConnell is notorious for keeping his cards very close to his chest. He doesn't even reveal his strategy very often to his leadership team. But what we can do is read between the lines and try to game out his strategy. There are a couple theories of what McConnell is wanting out of this 2 week delay, or this half 3 week delay, really, of this impeachment trial. He says publicly that it is because the House of Representatives rushed the process. There was not evidence presented. There was limited debate. And so that the president deserves the time to prepare an adequate defense and for there to be a real trial in the Senate. But there's a couple other rumors and speculation that people who I'm talking to, sources, Republican and Democrat, are saying, and it's unclear which one is accurate, but I'm going to lay them out here in the sense that some are saying that McConnell, who is no longer a fan of the president, thinks that if a 2 week delay could actually mean that more evidence comes out, more evidence is presented that makes a stronger case against the president and makes it easier for him and his Republican conference to convict him. The other side is that a 2 week delay means that emotions settle a little bit. Remember, these senators are really the witnesses in this trial. They're the ones that experienced this siege. They're the ones who had to be rushed out of the Senate floor, out of the Capitol, as these insurgents were storming their property and their space. And people are extremely angry about it, and they still are shaken and about it. So McConnell publicly is saying that the president needs time to prepare a defense. He finally has an attorney. But it's an interesting strategy from McConnell, and it's one where he's still trying to have, even though he's not majority leader, he's still trying to have a lot of say in how the process moves forward.
And Leanne, I wonder what that calculus looks like for other senators, Republican senators, because as you're saying, they personally experience this. But at the same time, there are others who are warning that McConnell could face a serious backlash if he votes to convict Trump. And we know that when we look at polling, that there are Republicans in the country that don't support this impeachment and, in fact, say they want to vote out Republicans who would do that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder where this puts McConnell in terms of his long-held grip on the GOP.
Yes, it's a really interesting dynamic. Everything that McConnell does is to maintain his grip on power. Every decision he makes politically, policy-wise, is to ensure that he is majority leader, or in this case, wins back majority leader in 2 years after the midterm elections. He has a lot of senators who are up for re-election in 2022, across the board, from Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, who hasn't said yet if he's going to run for re-election, but he has been a Trump ally, to James Lankford in a conservative state of Oklahoma, who shocked everyone when he originally said that he was going to object to the Electoral College count on January 6th in Congress. He ended up reversing that decision after the riots. And then a member of leadership, Roy Blunt, McConnell's number three, is Missouri, is also up for re-election. And Blunt often sticks very closely with McConnell's positions. So the midterm elections are going to be a big pull here. But then on the other hand, McConnell's having to make the wage the challenges he has, because a conviction in the Senate would mean that Donald Trump can't run for office again. And so would it help to sideline the president, at least politically, if there is a conviction? But on the other hand, the Republican base, the Trump base, is still relatively strong. But McConnell has also been a very open, even after the last election when Trump lost and House Republicans did better than expected. But the Republicans are losing the suburbs, and McConnell says that they need to get those suburbs back. And so that is also a factor. There are political factors. There's, you know, moral factors. He's taking the country and democracy into consideration as well. It's going to be a very interesting dynamic to watch.
Just important, just to clarify, I said articles of impeachment. Strictly speaking, it is a article of impeachment. One, Shane, what I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in here.
Well, I think that Leanne's right. I mean, the political dynamics of this are fraught, and I think that the stakes are really the future of the Republican Party. I mean, there are clearly these camps that have become delineated between people who believe that Donald Trump, and if you want to call it Trumpism, is the future of the party and where the base is at, and others who, and I think McConnell probably is in that camp, certainly Romney and Sasse and some other more moderate Republicans, who feel that this is the way to just political isolation and irrelevance, that you have to grow the party. You can't, you know, to Leanne's point, you have to look at these suburban voters who are traditionally Republican, who they're losing. You know, it would be, I think, a benefit for many political presidential aspirants in the Republican Party in 2024 to have Donald Trump effectively neutralized and taken off the field. But many of those people in the Senate who might like to run 2024 will have to take a vote to do that. So, you know, if you are Josh Hawley or you're Tom Cotton, and you want to appeal to those Trump voters, but you would also like to have Donald Trump not as your competitor, what do you do? I mean, do you vote to remove him? There's also a question, too, which I think is interesting. Constitutionally, I mean, I've been talking to some experts and some lawyers about this. It's not entirely clear to me that you have to impeach him in order to do the vote to bar him from office. Now, the impeachment train is moving. I think that's kind of maybe an irrelevant point. But there are other ways, absent even impeachment, that the Congress could vote to stop him from running again.
I want to thank Leanne Caldwell for joining us, a congressional correspondent with NBC News. Thank you, Leanne.
Thank you.
We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
To become a world champion in freediving, Tanya Streeter learned to breathe like this. Ideas about air, breath, and breathing. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
It's the news roundup. Let's jump back into the conversation. Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's also co-host of the podcast What the Health. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
What we wanted to focus on was the coronavirus. The U.S. surpassed 400,000 coronavirus deaths on Tuesday, Trump's last full day in office. Inauguration officials lit 400 lights along the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool to commemorate the dead. Yesterday, President Biden had a less than optimistic assessment of the months ahead.
Let me be very clear. Things are going to continue to get worse before they get better. The memorial we held two nights ago will not be our last one, unfortunately. The death toll will likely top 500,000 next month. The cases will continue to mount. We didn't get into this mess overnight, and it's going to take months for us to turn things around. But let me be equally clear. We will get through this. We will defeat this pandemic. And to a nation waiting for action, let me be the clearest on this point. Help is on the way.
Julie, before we get to that help part, where are we with the pandemic right now?
Well, we are not in a good place. Against all medical advice, people traveled at Thanksgiving, they traveled at Christmas, they traveled at New Year's. We saw the predicted spike. Dr. Fauci in the White House briefing room yesterday said that it looks like perhaps that spike is leveling off, but we know that COVID has a long tail. People get sick, and it takes several weeks for them to get sick enough to be in the hospital, and then another several weeks for deaths to occur. So, you know, even that spike from the end of December, we're still experiencing. There are, as Shane mentioned, you know, we're getting a little bit faster at giving the vaccines, but the vaccines are not going as fast as the virus is spreading.
And when we think about President Biden's assessment, are health experts by and large agreeing with that in terms of where we're at?
Yeah, that's where President Biden is getting his information. He had this COVID advisory group that included some of the top public health officials in the country, and he's listening to them and basically saying what they have told him.
And so when we're looking at 10 executive orders President Joe Biden signed geared toward fighting the pandemic, he's expected to sign more today. Julie, which of these orders jumped out to you? What do you think would make the biggest difference in the months ahead?
Well, I think sort of taken together, they're trying to organize chaos, if you will. We have lots of vaccines going out and lots of vaccines being given, but a survey out this morning from my colleague to the Kaiser Family Foundation found that of those people who are high up in the priority, so adults aged 65 and over, 60% don't know when they'll be eligible to get a shot, and 55% don't know where they can go to get a shot. 55% of essential workers and 21% of health workers don't know when it will be their turn to get the vaccine. So I think there's an effort here to try to grab a hold of this, set some federal guidelines, give federal help. Some of this is going to require Congress to either authorize it or provide money for it. But it's really an effort to kind of take a hold of everything and see if people can actually understand more of how to get tested, how to get the vaccine, when it's their turn, without actually federalizing the entire effort. Just sort of give it, have a place for people to go where they can find the information that they need.
Shane, when we think about the fact that President Biden announced his pandemic plan on Thursday, it's 200 pages long. Can you give us a brief overview of what he's looking to do with that and how much that addresses what Julie was just talking about?
Well, I think, you know, to her point, this is not a federalization, right, of the plan. It's not as though the federal government's going to come over and take this over from the states. But clearly there are sort of key points of tension here, or maybe even we can think of them as sort of places where the federal government can step in and make things easier, right? So, I mean, for instance, they are going to try and play a role in making more large sites open for mass testing. Maybe that will be in stadiums or, you know, in other large facilities. Can they dispatch National Guard to help with distribution, logistics, even lending equipment that hospitals might need. There's some of that that's addressed in some of these orders as well. One order is going to give governors more help by directing the Federal Emergency Management Agency to pay states for using members of the National Guard and their supplies. So it's almost like, and he's hired, importantly, a guy named Jeff Zients, who is sort of a organizational guru to be the coordinator of this and who has history in the Obama administration and the private sector on this as well, trying to find those places of where, okay, where can the federal government kind of push, and you know, either with its, if it's with money or personnel or kind of clearing obstacles out of the way to, you know, as Julie said, organize this very chaotic response. I thought it was also notable that Anthony Fauci was a little bit defensive in trying to say that, like, all the ideas from the Trump administration, of course, which he was a part, were bad. There are some things that he thought were good and they're bringing forward. But this is, you know, what's striking to me, I guess, in the overall is how different it is to see a president taking seriously a pandemic that has killed 400,000 people. President Trump, after Election Day, never mentioned the coronavirus again or these massive amounts of deaths, really, until a kind of perfunctory glancing acknowledgement of the deaths as he was leaving on his last day in office. So it's just such a profound, even rhetorical shift, but it's backed up clearly with a lot of thinking that they've been doing for a number of months on how to try and get in here and use the power of the federal government to try and, you know, get us through this last stage and then start repairing the economy.
Julie, how important is it to have moments, to Shane's point, about, I'm thinking of this inauguration pool, the inauguration reflecting ceremony that they had at the reflecting pool, Joe Biden having a moment of silence in his address. How important do you think that is?
I think it's really important that what we've really lacked on this effort is leadership. We've had a whole lot of people sort of scurrying around doing things, and obviously they did some very good things. We have two really effective vaccines that are now available, but this was the first that memorial the night before the inauguration with the lights that they did very purposely right at dusk was the first national acknowledgement of how many people we've lost and how many people are suffering. That's really been sort of glossed over. It's just been numbers. And that really brought, you know, a moment of national attention to this. And I think that that was Joe Biden saying, and you know, what really struck me from what he said yesterday is that we're in a national emergency. It's time we treated it as one. That's really been, you know, the entire time the Trump administration tried to downplay the pandemic, saying it's going to get better. We're taking care of it. Everything's fine, when everything clearly was not fine. And now we have Joe Biden coming and saying everything is not fine and we're going to do what we can to fix it.
Julie, to Shane's point about the states versus a federal effort, what are states saying they need? Is it money? Is it logistics? Is it organization? All three?
Yes, it's definitely all three. One of the things that sort of jumped out at me from some of the executive orders is that the president is ordering FEMA to create a point person for every state so that states will actually have a designated person they can go to saying, we need more PPE, we need more National Guard to, you know, to help set things up. We need more people who can actually deliver the vaccines. It's not just a shortage of vaccine itself. It's a shortage of people who are trained to actually give the vaccines. So they won't just have to sort of go through the bureaucracy. The president said that was something that they started after Superstorm Sandy, which of course affected most of the states up and down the eastern seaboard and did a lot of damage. And he said they want to put that to work. So there are things like that. You know, as I said and as Shane said, it's not an effort to federalize the entire fight. It's an effort to help the states with what they need to speed things up and organize it.
I wanted to shift gears for a moment and talk about the vaccine. And on Monday, health officials in Maine discovered that more than 4,000 doses of one Moderna vaccine shipment were damaged because it wasn't kept in adequate temperatures. A Moderna vaccine shipment of 12,000 doses on its way to Michigan was also found damaged and is being replaced. Julie, are these just one-off occurrences?
Well, one certainly hopes so. It's interesting that in one case, the vaccine got too warm, and in the other case, it got too cold. And of course, this is the Moderna vaccine. This is not the Pfizer vaccine. It's the one that needs to be kept at those ultra-cold temperatures. This is the vaccine that's a little bit more forgiving in in terms of temperature. But again, these are, you know, part of the supply chain that Jeff Zients, who's rather well known to health reporters as the guy who came in and fixed healthcare.gov when it crashed in 2013. These are the sorts of things that the federal government is supposed to work with states and with the manufacturers and with the people who are actually doing the deliveries to try to straighten out, because we really don't have that much extra vaccine. And it is a tragedy when vaccines are lost because of shipping problems.
So what is the status of vaccine shipments across the country more broadly? How is it going?
Well, it hasn't been going very well. At the urging of the Trump administration and now the Biden administration, a lot of states have expanded eligibility sort of beyond that, you know, very first priority group, which was frontline healthcare workers and people in nursing homes. They've expanded it to people in some cases over 75, in some cases over 65, to more health workers. And so they've opened it up. Appointments have been hard to get. And then sometimes when people have gone to their appointments, states have run out of vaccines. They just don't know how much they're getting. So they've been making appointments and then they can't fulfill those appointments. And that's one of the problems. It's just been really chaotic and disruptive. And I have so many friends and people I don't know on Twitter who've just spent days trying to get appointments for their parents who can't possibly navigate some of the ways you have to go in and sign up to get an appointment to maybe get a vaccine.
Shane, what is the conversation in Washington about how these issues can be mitigated in the future?
Well, I think the conversation has been largely was around getting money to the states in the most recent stimulus package, which is going out. And when Biden says help's on the way, one of the forms of those help will be to money for the states to actually roll these things out and try and communicate with people more, hire more people to get those vaccines into people's arms. But I think that, you know, as we were saying earlier, when the Trump administration was in charge of this effort, it was almost like this kind of faded into the background. And my sense was that, well, okay, great, vaccines are here. We'll be turning a corner soon enough. You know, members of Congress got theirs right away and were famously photographed getting shots in the arm. It didn't feel to me, I think, that there was that kind of urgency around it to really remedy the kind of dysfunction that Julie has been describing here, where we say, yeah, we have, you know, amazingly these incredible vaccines, possibly one more on the way from Johnson & Johnson. But it turns out that in all the months of planning that Operation Warp Speed was doing to get these things ready, there was maybe no logistical plan that was in place. So it's almost like the conversation starts anew with, okay, how do we actually get our hands around this, and what can Washington do immediately to start to remedying these problems?
Shane, when we're thinking about what Washington can do on the possible role of the National Guard in vaccine distribution, are there any conversations about how they should not be used for this?
Well, I don't know about not be used for it. I mean, I think that there is a kind of hesitation probably, and Julie, we could speak to this, I think, maybe even better than me, but in the public health community generally, the reason that you want states to be able to carry out public health program and things like vaccine distribution is because they know the realities in their states. They know the populations. They know maybe where the vaccine needs to go first. So I think there's perhaps a hesitation to try and, you know, use like the U.S. military to do that. But the National Guard is there essentially at the command of the governors. So if there is logistical support and rollout that they could be used for, I would imagine that state officials would welcome that. And, you know, I don't see why the federal government would necessarily stand in the way of that.
Julie, what do you think?
You know, this is a population by population effort, and that's something else that the Biden administration is doing that the Trump administration really didn't, which is we have a lot of vaccine hesitance. You know, right now we have people clamoring. There's more people who want the vaccine than there is vaccine, but that will straighten itself out soon enough, and then we'll be getting to the people who are worried about getting the vaccine. And one of the concerns is, do they necessarily want to get, you know, the vaccine from somebody who's wearing a military uniform, even if they're in the National Guard? And what are we going to do about hard to reach areas? One of the other elements of this plan is to create mobile vaccine clinics that can go to rural areas and to allow, you know, sort of more distribution in more places. But there is going to be a communications effort. And that really, people don't trust the federal government to say you should get the vaccine. They trust people that they trust. And those are the people who need to be, you know, sort of helped to be trained so what they can say, because if enough people don't eventually get the vaccine, we won't have herd immunity.
As we think of this historic week of an inauguration, as we think about the coronavirus death toll, what to you is sort of the moment that stands out to you this week? Shane?
Well, honestly, it was the COVID memorial. It was just such a subdued and incredibly solemn ceremony and a reminder of exactly what we're up against. And we've kind of forgotten that in the midst of the political tumult. And, you know, and it's not a happy subject to think about the fact that, you know, nearly 500,000 Americans will be dead by the end of next month. So I thought that that kind of set the tone of reflection appropriately and getting people ready for hopefully turning a corner to brighter days. But that really was the piece that stood out to me and I thought was something that the country really needed.
Julie?
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was not prepared for how moved I was by that memorial. They got also got very lucky. We had a really beautiful sunset over Washington, and everything was just so quiet because, of course, Washington is completely shut down. But it really was something that I think a lot of people needed.
Right. Just that moment, as you said, the importance of having that national acknowledgement and having a moment to just sort of pause and think about everything that's been happening. Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's also co-host of the podcast, What the Health. Julie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Shane Harris covers intelligence and national security for The Washington Post, and he also has his own podcast, Rational Security. Thank you for being with us as well, Shane.
Thanks very much.
1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of the Axios Today podcast, in for Jen White in Washington. For the next hour, we plan to look past some of the drama that has unfolded here in the nation's capital and catch up on the biggest stories from overseas. Our guests on the roundup this week are Nancy Youssef, who covers national security for The Wall Street Journal. Great to have you back, Nancy.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Paul Danahar is Washington bureau chief for the BBC. He's also author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Daniel Kurtz-Phelan is the executive editor of Foreign Affairs and author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. Dan, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks. Always great to be here.
World leaders welcome President Biden to the global stage, many with a sigh of relief. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen did not mince words this week when speaking to the European Parliament.
Once again, after four long years, Europe has a friend in the White House. This new dawn in America is the moment we've been waiting for so long. Europe is ready for a new start with our oldest and most trusted partner.
That was European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Nancy, how is the rest of the world reacting to this transition?
Well, I'm a newspaper reporter, and so I have an affinity for newspaper front pages on major news events, and I couldn't help but check out some of the reaction around the world. And the most common quote from Biden's speech was, "Democracy has prevailed." And what's interesting is when Biden delivered that line, he prefaced it by saying, "at this hour." And I point that out to say because in the run-up to the inauguration, there was real anxiety. You know, we before this talked about the peaceful transfer of power as a given, and in this case, it wasn't. With the insurrection that happened on January 6th at the steps of the Capitol, the haunting streets of Washington filled more with National Guardsmen than anything else. And so there was sort of, from what I saw, a sort of short-term reaction that there was a real anxiety leading up to it. Would it truly be peaceful in that final hour? Would there be a peaceful transfer of power? And then longer term, a world that sees in the new president someone who's an internationalist, who has said that he wants to engage on issues like climate change and COVID, who wants to enter multilateral agreements again. And so you saw, I think, a sort of short-term reaction in terms of just real anticipation about whether there there would be a peaceful transfer, given all the optics we saw running up to it. And then I think different expectations going forward about what this would mean from having an American president who has signaled his interest in engaging with the world.
And when we think about that going forward, Dan, I wonder what are some of the major relationships you expect maybe to change with this new Biden administration?
Yeah, so I mean, you saw, as you put it, the sigh of relief, but I think that subsided pretty quickly among both allies and adversaries of the United States who moved right away to, you know, look out for their interests. And it was clear quite quickly that a lot of these issues that had been kind of swamped by the Trump show in Washington are not going to be that easy to solve just because Biden has taken power in Washington, D.C. So I expect that, first of all, China will continue to be the, you know, kind of obsession of the American foreign policy establishment and probably the biggest issue of the next 4 years and beyond. And for all the change, you know, given how much dissension there was between China and Donald Trump, in some ways there's an opportunity for a new start here. But you've seen a kind of commitment to the harder line that has been embraced under Trump, even by the Biden officials. So there might be some change in atmospherics, but again, that will be a very, very tense relationship. And then, you know, you have, of course, the celebrations from a lot of the traditional American allies in Europe. You see these very, very large majorities in places like Germany and France, really changing their view of the United States. And when you ask them if they trust Biden to do the right thing in world affairs, you have very, very high levels of trust. But then also, it's worth noting a number of allies and partners in the United States who were pretty happy with what they were getting from Donald Trump, whether, you know, the Gulf Arab states or Israel, who were approved of that hard line against Iran that they shared with the Trump administration, or Narendra Modi in India, who was very happy they didn't have an American president bugging him about human rights and some of his domestic policies. So you get that sigh of relief in the short term, but these are still going to be tough relationships going forward.
When we're thinking about, Dan, to your point, the European reaction, French President Emmanuel Macron tweeted, "We will be stronger to face the challenges of our time, stronger to build our future, stronger to protect our planet. Welcome back to the Paris Agreement." Paul, I wanted to ask you about this because as part of the slew of Biden executive orders reversing Trump administration actions, the U.S. did rejoin both the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Accord this week. Can we rejoin with just a presidential signature?
Well, that's how we left. Rather, that's how America left. I mean, I think the thing about the climate change deal, it kind of epitomized in many ways the disruption of Donald Trump. I mean, they'd spent 9 years building this kind of delicate tower of cards, and he walked straight in on day one and kicked it over. I think the thing that people are most going to look forward to in a post-Trump relationship is the lack of unpredictability about the new administration. The problem, even for those people that got what they wanted out of Trump, was they didn't know how long it was going to last. I mean, they could have a deal with him on Monday. On Tuesday, he could be tweeting that he hates them. I think, you know, there's a general acceptance around the rest of the world that, you know, if Washington, D.C., as one of my colleagues put it, goes from crazy town to Dollsville, they'd rather have that. They just want to have a rough idea what the policies of America are going to be and have an expectation that they will stay in place for, you know, a couple of weeks rather than a couple of hours, depending on, you know, which way the president's thumbs happen to be tweeting on that day.
Paul, the idea of the Paris Climate Accord, to your point of how much work went into it, what happens now with the U.S. officially rejoining?
Well, the thing about climate change is the only way you can get countries like China and India, and they are massive polluters, on board to do anything, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, is to have America driving the process. The idea behind the Paris Agreement was to reduce global warming, to make sure that the planet didn't go up above another 2 degrees, preferably 1.5 degrees. But there's an acceptance that basically the Europeans can't do it on their own because they just aren't powerful enough to change the minds of India and China. And so, it was going nowhere, frankly, without America. So having America back on board and having America in the driving seat gives hope to the Europeans and many other nations around the world that this thing will finally move forward, because without America, it was going to hit the rails.
When we're thinking about, Paul, to your point of changes, another day one policy change included rescinding President Trump's travel ban on predominantly Muslim countries. Nancy, what does this change mean?
Well, if you'll recall, this was enacted on January 27th, 1 week into the Trump administration. I was actually there at the Pentagon when it was signed, and it really caught everyone by surprise. You'll remember there were scenes at the airport of people who had valid visas when they got on the plane, suddenly not allowed inside the country. And it really kind of set the tone for the Trump administration policy. It became a signature legislation that banned, I shouldn't say legislation, an executive order that banned people from from a dozen countries, and the majority of them Muslim. And, you know, there's a real world impact on hundreds of thousands of people. It stranded refugees. It kept families apart. It kept people who were ill from getting critical health care. It arguably led to a shortages of doctors and parts of rural America. And so and as part of these slew of executive orders that were signed within hours of the Biden administration, this was rescinded. And so it will take weeks to sort of enact, sort of practically speaking, as you start to open embassies and consulates again, but also because of COVID, the ability to sort of resume that travel. And what we heard from the Biden administration is rather than putting a ban on countries, which from their perspective didn't make America more secure, that going forward that they would enact better policies and procedures to vet those seeking visas and entry into the United States.
Nancy, what else stands out to you when we look at President Biden's other early decisions on immigration?
Well, we've heard from him that that immigration would be a priority. We saw the decision to end the construction of the border wall, which again was a sort of a signature part of the Trump administration policy. What we've heard from the Biden administration is rather than bans and walls and this idea of extreme vetting that we heard from the Trump administration, that there would be smarter policies, more refined policies, that is their aim, and that immigrants is a cornerstone of the American experience rather than something to be treated as an imminent threat to the United States.
Dan, just quickly wanted to ask you what we're hearing, for example, from Mexico when it comes to this.
So Mexico has walked a very delicate line over the past 4 years with Trump, trying not to get on his bad side, especially under the new president, López Obrador, and to that end, being pretty helpful when it comes to acceding to his hardline immigration policies. Now that there's this change in Washington, you've heard from President López Obrador that he wants to see real immigration reform, and Biden is committed to that, and so that would be something that Mexico would certainly approve of.
By a near unanimous 93-2 vote, the Senate has confirmed President Biden's nominee for Defense Secretary, retired Army General Lloyd Austin. So lots going on. Dan, I wanted to get back to your point about not everyone being happy with President Biden's early policy changes. And I wanted to talk about Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, disappointed that the new administration has canceled the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. Can you please remind us what we need to know about this pipeline and this move in particular?
So this was one of Biden's, really one of the first steps he took upon becoming president. The Keystone XL pipeline is this, you know, very controversial and long debated project to take crude oil from the oil sands in Western Canada and transport it into and through the United States. It's been controversial for environmental reasons, obviously, also because it crosses some Native American lands. So it's been a source of controversy for some time. Obama first blocked it in 2015, then Trump restarted it, and now Biden has canceled it again. And it's a reminder of the tough balance that Trudeau has been trying to strike for a long time between the fact that Canada's economy is really dependent on oil, and at the same time he wants to show himself a leader on climate change, but then also of the balance that American allies are trying to strike generally. You know, they want to project goodwill and get off on the right foot with a new administration, but they're also going to have disagreements with Biden or with U.S. policy more generally that they're not, easily able to wish away. So you saw Trudeau, fairly muted in his reaction. He said we're disappointed, but acknowledged the president's decision. So he didn't, he was not vituperative in his objections, but it's not going to be easy for him. And it also underscores something that Paul mentioned earlier although it may be even worse than he said, and that's the just erraticness of U.S. policy. You know, a commitment from one American president might only last until the next election, and that makes it much harder for other governments, even if they're, you know, well disposed to the United States, to really tether their economic or security interests to U.S. policy. So you see that with this, but also with the Iran deal and plenty of other examples, which you know, have kind of ping-ponged back and forth between administrations.
Let's shift to events in Russia this week. Alexei Navalny knows how to be Russian President Vladimir Putin's fiercest foe, even from prison. After recovering from a poisoning in Germany, he flew home to Russia this week only to be promptly arrested and within 48 hours released a new video accusing Putin of a massive corruption scheme. Nancy, first, can you tell us why he was arrested this most recent time?
Well, the official reason was that he had violated the terms of a suspended sentence from a 2014 embezzlement conviction, which many believe was sort of a case created to come after him. And the violation was that he left the country, and he left the country to get treatment for being poisoned, many believe, by the Russian government. And so I find it extraordinary that he traveled back. He knew that there was a very likely chance that he would be arrested. The court proceeding, the first one, was at a police station, and it gives you a sense of sort of how unconventional the approach was towards him. And now he has a February 2nd court hearing and could be held in jail for 3.5 years to finish out that sentence within jail. And so I thought it was his return was a symbolic act of defiance. And it's interesting, we were talking earlier about democracy and the symbols of democracy. This is someone who has really taken this on to great risk to him, and decided to return knowing all the risks. It would have been arguably easier for him to continue his work in exile, but not only did he return knowing that that arrest was very likely, he said he wasn't afraid, and as you mentioned, released a video hours later, within a day, outlining Putin's corruption in the form of a $1.4 billion palace. I was watching it in the run-up to the show, and it's captivating and so detailed, and clearly years of work put into it. So
this video, Nancy, this video is really wild. Let's just play a little clip of this video that has now gone viral.
Самый секретный и охраняемый объект в России без преувеличения. Это не загородный дом, не дача, не резиденция.
So, obviously on Russian, but if you look at it, with the scale of this is extraordinary. Paul, what's the story behind this video?
Well, the claim is, by Mr. Navalny, that lots of Putin's inner circle, which includes oil chiefs and billionaires and whatnot, have built out this, basically, resort town for him in a place called Gelenzich. Probably pronouncing that wrongly. But basically, the allegation is that all of his mates have piled in with lots of money to build him an absolutely fantastic palace on the Black Sea resort. And this has all gone on, you know, behind closed doors and money under the table. And while it's not in Putin's name, it's his. And it's basically, what you're saying is, it's entirely corrupt. I mean, this is just, it's 27 square miles of just amazing property. It's got a vineyard, it's got an ice hockey complex, it's got a theater, it's got a church. I mean, it's just
an underground tunnel to go to the beach.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a little town all on its own. So the allegation is that, you know, his mates have bought him this. And why have they bought him this? Obviously, the implication is because he's done him a lot of favors.
And so, just to be clear, what exactly is Navalny accusing Putin of doing?
Being corrupt. Basically, what he's saying is he's done deals with people and spent, you know, millions and millions of dollars of illicit funds, which the allegation clearly that he's saying is you've been given all this, you've been given this property, which is valued at around $1.3 billion. Well, what did you do in return? And that's basically what he's saying is we don't know what he's done, but look, he must have got something in return for something as enormous as this.
Dan, how are we seeing Putin responding to this video?
So this comes at a very vulnerable moment for Putin. In some ways, you know, the events of the past week go to some of the things that most irritate and in some ways threaten him, both the with a new administration in Washington that is speaking out on issues of kind of democracy and human rights in Russia for the first time in 4 years. And then these allegations of corruption, which really go to, the heart of his image within Russia. So he has responded very forcefully, especially to a series of protests that are supposed to come tomorrow. He's denied the underlying allegations that Paul referred to, but as protests are planned around Russia tomorrow, the Russian authorities have made very, very clear that they're going to take tough action against them.
That was my next question, Danny. What are we seeing from Russian people? What the reaction is to this?
So it's been one of the stronger reactions against Putin and his kind of turn to authoritarianism and corruption that you've seen for a long time. So you've seen a number of kind of prominent Russian figures, including the captain of the national soccer team and hockey stars, who have kind of aligned with Navalny against Putin, which is a fairly rare occurrence. So as you see protests planned for tomorrow, the Kremlin does seem to be nervous and is taking a fairly tough line. So you have, it's kind of this amazing duel of bravado between these two figures that are not really standing down. And I expect tomorrow will be quite striking in terms of both the display from Russian protesters, but also the response from the Kremlin.
And speaking of strong reactions, protests are continuing in India. Earlier this week, India's government offered to suspend the implementation of three new laws that have triggered the biggest farmers' protests in years. Tens of thousands have been camped on the outskirts of New Delhi, and they don't appear to be going anywhere. There's so much at stake for both sides here. Paul, who do you think blinks first?
It's going to be really difficult. I mean, the farmers have been camped out since the 26th of November. And basically, you've got two almost immovable forces. Modi needs to kind of bring this to an end because he can't afford to look weak in the face of mass protest. But these farmers genuinely believe that they are fighting for their lives, because as far as they're concerned, these new rules, which will basically expose them to the free market, when many of them live pretty much kind of hand to mouth, could just wipe out their livelihood. So I think eventually a way will be found for the farmers to basically get what they want, but in a way that kind of keeps Modi from having to admit that that's what he's done. You've got a big Indian kind of independence celebration going on later this January. That's when the whole of that area that they're protesting, they've been protesting around, will be used for sort of celebrations and parades. So I think there'll be an attempt by the government to try and stop this dragging on beyond January, because it's really embarrassing. Modi's managed to project himself as being the strong man of India. He's managed to kind of push his way through all forms of protest and to completely dominate the opposition politicians. So this is important for him. He can't afford to look weak, but he's facing an opposition group that, frankly, has got nowhere else to go.
Paul, can you remind us why this wipes out their livelihoods, these farmers?
Well, basically, in India, the farmers get a guaranteed price for their products. What this plan is going to do is open them up to the free market. But they'll be able, what its proponents say is, they'll be able to sell their products directly to private buyers, and that will give them an opportunity to get a better price. At the moment, they sell to the government, and the government controls the prices. What concerns the farmers is that they are, many of them, small businesses, and that they will be completely ravaged by big multinational firms, and that they will be destroyed. And so basically, this is, much of India survives on farmland, and that's what keeps, many, many people going. They literally are growing and eating and surviving with their families on the small amount of product that they can actually grow. So they're just nervous about the fact that if this doesn't work out for them, they will lose their livelihoods and they'll have nothing.
Paul, I know the BBC reported this week more than half of Indians work on farms, but that sector accounts for barely a sixth of the country's GDP. How do you see this changing, and how soon do you see this changing?
The problem that India's got, unlike China, if you look at how the two countries have evolved over the last 20 years, China has invested incredibly in infrastructure, and India hasn't. Its infrastructure is appalling. I mean, you know, so much produce is lost on the way to the ports, and then when it gets to the ports, it's kind of locked outside because it's so disorganized. India's made its money in recent years through service industries, from the fact that many, many people speak English, and the internet allows them to basically ignore the roads and go straight up and, you know, via the internet. So until India can actually build up its infrastructure, it's not going to be able to bring the farmers into the wider economy. And so therefore, they're always going to be hanging on the edge of dropping into poverty. And that's why a kind of a move like this scares them, you know, completely witless.
Dan, I know you mentioned this before when we're thinking about India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has a reputation as a take no prisoners politician. Do you feel like he's met his match with these farmers engaging in some of the largest protests the world has ever seen?
That's right. So Modi, when he came into office in 2014, his message was really centered on this kind of market-friendly economic reforms. He turned pretty quickly after taking office to focusing much more on right-wing Hindu nationalist policies. And that was in part because he discovered that, you know, some of these economic reform issues are really, really tough. So he has been really forceful on some of that kind of Hindu majoritarian politics, but in fact not been nearly as aggressive on reform as people expect him to be. And this is probably a reminder of why it's such a difficult thing to do. I think that Paul is probably right that Modi will find some kind of face-saving way to withdraw. He'll say there is some kind of reform still going forward. But it does not just present a kind of striking picture of some of the largest protests the world has ever seen, but really some of the strongest reaction to Modi's rule in the past 6 years. And this could be a really a turning point in terms of his popularity in India, given just how many people make their living from agriculture and how much of a symbol of India that is.
There's another really big story that's been happening in India this week, described as the plunder down under. Here's why.
Hazelwood goes in and he gets a full toss and he drives it, threw it off. It's going down towards the boundary. It's going to go for four. It's all over. India have won. You could say this is one of the greatest wins India have ever had in their test history. Congratulations to India, who've won this game thrillingly by 3 wickets.
That was commentary from Jim Maxwell from the ABC in Australia on India's fantastic cricket series win in Brisbane. India's prime minister congratulated the team for its stellar intent, remarkable grit and determination. But this is more than a feel-good sports story. It's what happened next that took people by surprise. Paul, what happened next?
Well, look, the thing that was really important for what happened with India was the way that they won. What happened with them was that they were basically hammered in an earlier game. They had none of their star players. The captain was back home. They were bruised and battered and demoralized. And so basically everybody expected them to just get trashed. But they didn't. They won. And they came back. They won 2-1. It's been talked about being the greatest comeback in cricket history. And in a country that has such antagonism towards its neighbour, Pakistan, even the Pakistanis, Pakistani fans, Pakistani cricketsmen were coming out and applauding India's performance. So you've basically got, in a country that's already been like everywhere else, reeling by the COVID virus and all the other things that are going on in India, to suddenly have this battered B team, basically, win in such a staggering way. And it's being called the best test cricket win in India's history. And them to be applauded by Pakistan and everybody else, it's just, you know, it's really lifted a country out of the doldrums.
I wonder, when we think about Pakistan, how much of it might have been because I'm expressing solidarity because of the awful racist taunts that the Indian side faced from the Australian crowd. Do you think that had something to do with it?
Yeah, but I think the thing about India and Pakistan is that they both equally love cricket. It's just about the only thing that they can agree on, that it's the greatest game in the world. And so, I mean, I've kind of sat with colleagues before who are Indian and Pakistani, and, you know, when you get together, the first thing they bond over is cricket. So it's one of those things that probably the only thing, that, apart from maybe sort of Bollywood, that, that crosses the kind of very difficult boundaries between the two countries. So for Pakistan to kind of, you know, recognize the greatness of their neighbors, and honestly also, I mean, there is a sense in South Asia that it, you know, it's India versus Pakistan, but then it's South Asia versus the world. So there's also a little bit of being able to kind of, you know, give a kicking to the West in that circumstance. And as I say, cricket is the lifeblood of the nations, both nations. So, you know, that makes a difference.
It was a fitting end to an antagonistic 4 years between the Trump administration and China. During his final day in office, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declared that China is committing genocide against Uyghurs, the Muslim minority group living in the Xinjiang region. Pompeo explained this announcement Tuesday on Fox News.
I've referred to this over time as the stain of the century. It is truly that. And today's actions is simply a continuation of the work this administration has done to try and convince the Chinese Communist Party to cease this terrible, terrible set of human rights violations that have been taking place.
And then, Nancy, can you tell us more about what these human rights violations are that have been taking place?
Sure. So this was the strongest denunciation by any government against what's been happening there, in which we've seen up by the State Department's estimate, as many as too many Uyghurs, as well as other members of Muslim minority groups, being detained in these internment camps. The Chinese have said that these are necessary because of threats of extremism and terrorism in the area, and denied that these are human rights abuses. But of course, by every other estimation, they are in fact just that, and that their efforts at controlling the population, suppressing the population, torturing the population. And so, on the very last day of the Trump administration, we heard this denunciation by the Secretary of State. And so it was an interesting development because there had been disagreements throughout the Trump administration about whether to do this. There were some who felt that this jeopardized trade negotiations. John Bolton, in his book, said that Trump himself had objected to it, and in fact, at one point, had told Xi Jinping that he should continue building the camps. And so, this was an interesting and powerful message. But in the immediate, it doesn't change anything. The question becomes: what next? That this pronouncement, in and of itself, critics would argue, has to be met with some sort of action, and that will now fall on the Biden administration to do. Will we see other countries come forward and make similar proclamations? Will we see tangible action by the administration, the new administration, or by companies who are reticent to do business in Xinjiang, where these camps are?
Paul, given that the U.S. is the first country to use this word genocide, is there any indication other countries will follow?
Well, it's difficult because the dictionary definition of genocide means the mass killing of people. However, the UN's definition of genocide is more broad. It talks about measures to prevent births or to kind of destroy in part or in whole a national, ethnic or religious group. So there isn't, I mean, the UN have a version of it, but many countries don't really want to interpret the UN version of it because some of them could be accused of doing the same things in their own countries. So, I mean, I think the rest of the world will look rather cynically at this being a decision that Pompeo makes just as he walks out the door, and in some ways an attempt to just throw a spanner in the works of the Biden relationship with China. But there's no question that there is enormous concern about what China has been doing in Xinjiang, and they've been completely unrepentant about the process that they're carrying out there, locking a million people up, reprogramming their minds almost to kind of make them more like the kind of model Chinese citizen that the Chinese Communist Party wants. So I don't think that you're going to have a long line of people jumping on the bandwagon and suddenly calling what's going on there genocide. But I do think it forces other countries to basically have a serious conversation with themselves about how they deal with China and what they will do to try and stop them carrying out their plans in Xinjiang.
Nancy, what do we expect the Biden administration to do, to your point and to Paul's as well, that what happens next?
So we've heard from the Biden administration last summer through a spokesman also using the word genocide, and they have indicated that they will have a more aggressive posture on human rights specifically vis-a-vis China. We heard you mentioned earlier that the new defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, during his confirmation hearing, talking about China as a long-term threat militarily. We've seen signals from the Biden administration that they plan to take a more aggressive posture towards China on these issues. But we haven't seen a sort of spelled out policy in terms of what that means. Once, while they've stated that through a spokesman at least, that they believe that this is genocide, what that will lead to in terms of tangible policy. Could we see simple things like stronger claims for Uyghurs to claim asylum in the United States, for example? Would that kind of opening happen through the Biden administration? We know in sort of spirit that they plan to be more aggressive towards China, both in terms of military and human rights abuses, but the form that takes, I think we'll have to wait and see in terms of specifics.
We did see China responding swiftly to this designation of genocide by sanctioning 28 former Trump administration officials, including former Secretary of State Pompeo. They are now barred from visiting China or doing business with the country. And in a statement, China's foreign ministry wrote that, quote, some anti-China politicians executed a series of crazy moves which have gravely interfered in China's internal affairs. Dan, does these actions, these statements by China, make a difference? Because these are former officials.
That's right. So it's unlikely that this is going to, you know, materially impact the plans of, you know, Mike Pompeo or Steve Bannon in the coming months. I don't imagine that either one of them was planning to go, you know, on a trip to China or to, you know, go gambling in Macau after leaving government. But what it does do is, you know, kind of underscores just how much this relationship has deteriorated. The U.S. regularly, you know, sanctions Chinese officials, including those who are involved in some of the really terrible abuses in Xinjiang that Paul and Nancy spoke about. And China was essentially saying, look, we can play this game too. If you wanna sanction our people, we can sanction your people. There was also a portion of the Chinese sanctions that may be a little bit more consequential. They suggested that any businesses that work with some of these figures could also face threats to their ability to do business in China. So if you're a, you know, company imagining that you might want to put Mike Pompeo on your board after he leaves office, you might think twice about that if that provision turns out to have real meat behind it.
Paul, I wonder where you think the Trump presidency has left China-U.S. relations, especially as we think about these actions on the last day of office, China's response, especially when we're thinking about our economic relationship with China.
I think it was interesting watching Tony Blinken this week. I mean, about the only thing he said about the Trump administration that was in any way kind of praiseworthy was that they got tough with China. I mean, I was living in Beijing in 2008, just when it was getting ready for its Olympics. And, you know, there was a sense there that China really kind of thought that it could pretty much do what it wanted when it came to kind of business, that all these companies were coming in from America and doing exactly as they were told because they were so desperate to get into the Chinese market. And they all got burnt one way or another. All these people that made investments in China, they made money, but they also got burnt in terms of losing technology to China, seeing China kind of renege on deals or basically steal their technology. And so it's been growing since then. And I think basically pretty much the entire Western world now recognizes that the rise of China, there's some positive stuff about it, but there's also some negative stuff. They haven't seen the rise in China have a parallel change in attitude from the Chinese government. If anything, they've seen them get tougher, more restrictive, more kind of oppressive towards their people. And so the trade-off of doing deals with China, which was supposed to be China coming into the fold, hasn't happened. And I think the recognition now is, okay, we need a different plan. And Trump began that plan. And I think we'll find that the Biden administration will continue it. It will be less deliberately confrontational, but it may not be any less aggressive quietly when it comes to sitting in the negotiation room.
And I mean, I think when we think about all of these things that we've been talking about, whether it's China or India or actually Russia, Nancy, I did want to ask you one thing that we haven't talked about, which is there has been a lot of talk about President Biden's decision to investigate Russian hacking and election interference. There was a lot of conversation that would happen from day one. Did we hear about that this week?
We did. And, this week, and remember, we're days in the administration, we saw his sort of first foray into foreign policy, and it was towards Russia. He announced that he had asked for a full intelligence assessment on four things related to Russia: their interference in the 2020 election, the use of poison against Navalny, who we spoke about earlier, the hacking of government sites that we saw over the last month or so, and some would argue still is happening, and the potential that Russia was paying bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. I should note that we don't have a timeline for when that would come out or whether we would see a public report, but clearly in some of these issues, there's a sense of urgency. When it comes to the hacking, there is arguments that it's still happening, and of course, Navalny is in jail now, and potentially by the people who by every estimate, by the people who poisoned him. And so what I found interesting about this is, you know, under the Trump administration, we didn't see an aggressive push for intel on what the Russians were doing. And we saw this from the earliest days of the Biden administration. I should note that militarily, however, we saw more of a more status quo-like relationship. We saw the United States enter a five-year extension of its sort of centerpiece, the nuclear arms treaty, with Russia. And so it was an interesting push-pull, right? On the military side, we saw a more normal, consistent relationship. On other matters, on interference and intel, we saw a much more aggressive posture and a much more counter policy to what we saw under the Trump administration.
Let's talk about the Tokyo Olympics. After postponing the games by 12 months, International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach now says, let the games begin. Earlier this week, Bach told a Japanese news agency there was, quote, no reason whatsoever to believe that the Olympic Games in Tokyo will not open on July 23rd, end quote. He added, there's no plan B. Paul, it seems alarming to me that there's no plan B in the middle of the pandemic. How is the IOC planning to keep these games safe?
Look, I think we're going to end up with them basically being held behind closed doors in the same way that Premier League football in the UK, which is such a massive seller around the world and has such huge audiences, have decided that, okay, maybe a couple of 100,000 people can't enjoy them physically being there, but there's about 1 billion people around the world that do want to enjoy them. And I think we'll end up with the games going the same way. I mean, the problem is they can't delay it any further. It would mean that Japan would then have to reapply and maybe try and get the 2032 games, because they're not going to bounce the next two countries that are due to get them. I mean, and the thing, this is really important for Japan, because they've spent not only a lot of money, but I was in Japan when they had the World Cup, and you could see the way the Japanese suddenly embraced this kind of big international sporting event when all these people from around the world were coming. And I was also in Brazil when they had their Olympics. I was in Beijing when they had their Olympics. And it really feels like a moment of national pride when these things are held. People spend a lot of time getting excited, spend a lot of money, really gear themselves up for this event. And I don't think Tokyo will want to walk away from it. They won't have the crowds, they won't have the carnival atmosphere, but they will be a showcase for the world, because unquestionably the facilities they've built are superb. It will be a great games, because people are just desperate to go out there and compete, and the rest of the world is desperate to have something to watch apart from things on Netflix and really enjoy. So I think, you know, I think it will go ahead. It will be a different games, but then everything's different these days, and it will be enjoyed by people.
Dan, are we seeing any pushback to this then?
So the comments from both the from both Thomas Bach and from the Japanese Prime Minister over the last couple of days, in some ways feel like they're protesting too much. There have been a lot of reports coming out of Japan that there is growing opposition to holding the games this summer, given the pandemic and everything else happening, and that the Japanese public has turned against it. So amid these rumors that that a delay is almost inevitable, you have these very, very forceful responses from both the Olympic Committee and from the Japanese government. It's also worth noting that, you know, there is a kind of geopolitical significance to all this, both when it comes to Japan's desire to show its Kind of recovery from coronavirus, and then also from the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, which is part of this. It's what the Prime Minister said in Parliament this morning. But also, you know, remember the 2018 Olympics was a moment when North and South Korea marched together under one flag, and that kind of had a role in some of the diplomacy going on between the U.S. and North Korea. You see, you know, China and Russia are really intent on showing their prestige on the global stage at these kind of events. So this is not just about, you know, the enjoyment of people watching watching the events and watching the games, but also kind of has this overlay with international politics.
So, Nancy, how likely do you think it is that these Olympic Games will actually happen?
I think Paul's right when he says it probably will happen. That said, I mean, we're talking about 11,000 athletes, thousands of judges, VIP, media. If you have no audience there at all, it's still a humongous event. If they pull it off successfully, I think it'll be celebrated. If we see this lead to a COVID outbreak or something along those lines, there'll be a lot of we shouldn't have done it. And so it's a very risky proposition to hold these Olympics. And yet the alternative is to ask Tokyo, which has already spent $25 billion for these Olympics, to forego that. And so it seems it'll take some form, but the stadiums in Athens where the Olympics were born, that those images won't be there. We'll see a very sort of socially distanced Olympic, so a competitive but isolated experience.
And still have that music, which always evokes so many emotion. My thanks go to Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor of Foreign Affairs, and Paul Danahar, Washington bureau chief for the BBC. Thank you all. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. This podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Jen White is back on Monday. Let's talk more soon. This is 1A.